Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom. One of my favorite things to do is paddle on the Sacramento River in our family kayaks. It's both exciting, since the river is a powerful one with very cold water released from Shasta Dam, and relaxing. It's beautiful out there. Being on the river, it's easy to imagine yourself transported back in time to the Gold Rush era when the river was a major artery of transportation in Northern California. I've also been fascinated and perplexed by the fish that I know swim beneath my boat. Feeding on the bottom are green sturgeon, a huge and prehistoric fish that live for decades and can weigh hundreds of pounds, and the imperiled Chinook salmon, who venture from their spawning grounds in the gravel beds of tributary creeks to the Pacific Ocean beyond the Golden Gate. There are also introduced game fish prized by fishermen, including 30-pound striped bass and the hard-fighting spring-run American shad. One of the greatest rainbow trout fisheries in the world is found below Shasta Dam flowing through the city of Redding, where you can see guides taking their clients for the experience of a lifetime on their drift boats. Over the next hour, we'll hear from two men who are deeply enmeshed in the river's fishery issues. Later on, we'll talk to one of the many Sacramento River fishing guides, Mike Rasmussen, about what it takes to navigate the river's waters and help his clients have the fishing experience of their lives. But first, we'll have a conversation with Jim Smith. Smith is a senior biologist, the project leader for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Red Bluff office. The agency's biologists oversee the fishery below the Shasta Dam to the Diversion Dam in Red Bluff, where they manage fish traps used to keep tabs on anadromous fish populations in the river. Anadromous fish are those that spawn in fresh water, but then spend much of their lives in the ocean. He joined us from his home office via Skype. Jim Smith, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you very much, David. I'm glad to be here.
And how long have you been a working professional working for the Fish and Wildlife Service?
I started with Fish and Wildlife Service in 1979 up on the Columbia River. From there, I moved to Arcata. And then in 1983, I came over here to Red Bluff and the Valley, and I've been here ever since.
So have you seen a lot of changes over the years on the Sacramento River?
I have seen a lot of changes, both from the biology and from the politics.
Before we get into that, and we will, I'd like you to give us an overview of the Sacramento River watershed, especially for our listeners elsewhere who may not be familiar with it, because it really is one of the great fisheries in the United States, isn't it?
It certainly is, David. Especially in terms of salmon and steelhead, particularly for Chinook salmon, the Sacramento River used to, at least in my time here, harbored some of the largest Chinook salmon runs on the West Coast, and rivaling some of the numbers that were up in Alaska for Chinook salmon. That has changed over the years, particularly in more recent years with the droughts and the warmer water temperatures. But we did have some very large numbers of fish and very diverse group of fish on Chinook salmon. Here at Red Bluff, we had adult salmon going upstream every day of the year, and we had Chinook salmon juveniles coming by every day of the year. You will not find that anywhere else in the country.
Explain to us, there are four Chinook salmon runs, right? Can you explain to me how does that work?
Okay, there are four separate runs. They are called Fall Run Chinook, which is the main commercial and sport fishery fish. And then there is Spring Run, Winter Run. Those two are smaller numbers of returns. And then there is the Late Fall Chinook Salmon. And all of those are loosely defined, Late Fall Spring Run, by when the adults return to the mouth of the river. And I say loosely defined, that's just kind of a loose, there could be some overlap on either end of that in terms of the seasons. And so these fish, say for instance, Fall Run, come up starting roughly in September and October, some of them a little earlier, and then they go all the way into November and some into December. So that's how you define the difference.
And of course, we've had this extended drought over the last several years. How has that affected the Chinook salmon runs?
The salmon, particularly the spring run and the winter run, have been severely impacted by those. Those are mostly fish that are natural spawning fish. They don't have a whole lot of hatchery supplementation like the other two runs do. And so they have suffered very hard with the warmer water temperatures, particularly as it may affect spawning. Salmon require cold or cool water in which to lay their eggs. And if it gets much above 60 degrees when those eggs are incubating in the salmon nests, then they're pretty much die. And so that's really been hard with the lower water and the higher water temperatures for those fish.
You mentioned the environmental and political changes you've observed over the years. Could you give us an overview of what has changed and what you've seen?
When I first started here, salmon or steelhead or fish for any matter didn't really have a voice in how the water flows were released from the dams. You would talk to the dam operators and they might make some compromises on how they wanted to release water and provide water for other users. But not much. We might have one meeting a year in which we would talk with the operators and come up with some ideas about how to improve things as fish moved downstream primarily, or as they were coming upstream. That changed, particularly two things that drove that to change. One, that the winter run Chinook salmon were listed under the Endangered Species Act. That was the first Pacific Coast salmon listed, and that happened in 1988. And then in 1993, there was a law passed by Congress called the Central Valley Project Improvement Act, which is the Central Valley Project is the Bureau of Reclamation's dams and water releases up and down the river. It required them to start looking at fish equal to benefits for fish, equal to irrigation. And so that changed things a lot. It's the only Bureau of Reclamation project that requires them to consider its authority to provide for salmon and steelhead or anadromous fish, including sturgeon, too. So that was two big changes that changed things for the better. But it's really hard to help fish when there isn't water. Fish need water. And so when you've got droughts, it makes it very difficult to provide that water whether or not you want to or not. And that's been a real problem these last few years.
And so talk a little bit about what's the role of the California Department of Water Resources in working with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife as far as managing the salmon?
California Department of Water Resources is a state agency, and they operate on the Feather River. And they also operate a pumping facility down in the Delta. On the Feather River, primarily it's a state operation, so the federal government doesn't have a lot to say about what goes on there. With Fish and Wildlife Service, we do have what we call the Anadromous Fish Restoration Program. It's a particular program under the Central Valley Project Improvement Act law. And we work in a cooperative basis with the department. We can provide money for funds for different projects that might be ongoing. Basically, the Fish and Wildlife Service doesn't have a real strong regulatory hand, like say the California Department of Fish and Wildlife or the National Marine Fisheries Service, which is the federal organization that really is really responsible for managing the fishery. Fish and Wildlife Service is in the fishery is pretty much voluntary, and we try to work with partners trying to develop as many projects, both habitat, and we work with them on modifying operations to benefit anadromous fish.
What are some of the other interesting species that you guys study in the Sacramento River system?
The biggest thing that we've been doing here in the Upper Sacramento River, and really interesting, is with a green sturgeon. You know, they're a prehistoric fish. They've been around for millions and millions of years. And starting in 1995, nobody really knew that they spawned upstream here, and they thought they spawned in the same places as white sturgeon, which is more the recreational fish. But green sturgeon are really interesting because we didn't know much about them until we started catching some here in our juvenile traps at Red Bluff. And then more recently, we've been trying to find out when the juveniles are moving downstream and if they're being affected or impacted by various activities along the river. So that's been really interesting the last few years, something that nobody had done here in the Central Valley since we started it about 15 years ago. That's a really interesting critter.
And how big do they get?
Oh, green sturgeon, they'll get up to 6-7 feet long. They can be 40, 50 years old. But the eggs are very, very small. And it's really interesting that you get a little tiny egg or you get a little tiny fish, knowing that it could live for 50 years and inside of 4 or 5 years, it could be back in the river for 3-4 feet long and then grow to a much larger size. What we like to call, or at least I like to call it, charismatic megafauna. They're very interesting. People think they're scary. They eat. They just basically scoop up what's ever on the bottom and eat it. They don't really chase around it.
Yeah, so they're not going to attack you in your kayak or anything like that.
No, they do have. If you handle them though, they especially the little ones, they have very sharp. We call them scutes. They're bony plates on the outside of the animal. And so when they're young, they're very sharp. They're like little razor blades. When they get older, they start wearing them down, so they're not so much very sharp. But they're probably not much. Once they get above a certain size, they're not very good prey for other salmon or other predators like striped bass, or birds for that matter, because those little scutes can really cut the stomachs, the esophagus as they go down, and they don't seem to be much, we see some pretty good survival as these fish move downstream once they get to a certain size.
And what about some of the fish that are in the river that are not indigenous to the river, that are introduced?
There's two particularly introduced fish species, and that's striped bass and the shad. And both of those are pretty popular game fish. They were introduced back near the turn of the century, and when they were introduced in a lot of places. But they really took in the Sacramento River. Shad were actually released, first place they were released was off a rail car here in Tehama, the city of Tehama. But they were introduced, and for a long time those fish took off. They did really well. We had good salmon runs during the time we had striped bass. Striped bass are a pretty effective predator once they get up to an adult size. Shad not so much, but they can compete with salmon. But once they get to a certain size, they can be some pretty effective predators. And that with smaller numbers of salmon that are out here right now, they can be pretty important. They can be pretty effective on the populations and cause some difficulty for those populations.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. After a short break, we'll get back to our conversation with U.S. Fish and Wildlife biologist Jim Smith as we talk about the Sacramento River. Stay with us, and thanks for listening. we're back. Let's continue our conversation with U.S. Fish and Wildlife biologist Jim Smith as we examine the state of the Sacramento River fishery. So does that make it a good thing when, Sacramento River guides take people out and catch those striped bass?
Yes, I'd like them to catch as many as they can. Reducing that population would be good, but it's pretty difficult to do. Striped bass aren't easy to catch. You have a guide who can help you catch them, and you can find them, and that would be good if they can catch more. But they are a real popular sport fish. There have been some proposals out there to just do away with the bag limit, and take as many as you can. And that might work, but that's sort of what we call a predator control program. And sometimes predator control programs have undesired effects that you didn't really know when you started them. Coyotes up in the Arizona, they got rid of a bunch of coyotes, and then the prey overpopulated and started dying. But we also have another natural predator, natural origin predator or native predator, and that's pike minnow. And they can also be effective on salmon populations, juvenile salmon. And striped bass also eat pike minnow. So potentially if you reduce the numbers of pike minnow or reduce the numbers of striped bass, then that might allow the pike minnow population to increase. And so it's a net sum, you still got a lot of predators out there.
And you were telling me, we spoke the other day about those pike minnow. They have some really interesting behaviors. You were telling me about how they, when they get spooked, it's going to be extremely difficult to catch them. Could you tell us a little about that?
I can. One of the first tasks I had here was looking at Red Bluff Diversion Dam, and there were just tens of thousands of pike minnow below that dam. So we started trying to develop some kind of predator control methods, and that might take, start hook and line them or build traps. And so you could trap them and haul them away and just, drop the population numbers down. And what we found was that you could catch them for a little bit of time, and then they kind of go away. You don't know where they went, but you couldn't catch them anymore. We put traps in the Red Bluff Diversion Dam, and some had come up for a while, and then they stop. And what we found was that these pike minnow they get frightened, and they release this what we call a pheromone, and that would alert all of these other pike minnow in the area to hide and just go away for a while. And so you couldn't catch them anymore. They wouldn't go up the trap. You couldn't bait them into traps. And so that made them a lot harder to catch and control. And it's just it's pike minnow and that particular species or genera do that. It's something pretty interesting. It's obviously a method for survival for those fish.
I'd like to shift gears just a little bit and find out about what's the working day like for fisheries biologists. And in particular, I'd like to know, when I observe the people going out, tell us about the trapping system you have, the fish traps that you use. Describe how those work and what you use those for.
What we have here, and probably I think what you've seen, are juvenile traps at Red Bluff, and they're what we call rotary screw traps. So if they work very much like they were patterned after the old Archimedes screw for raising water up out of the river and into a irrigation canal. So it's really hard to describe, but it turns the water turns this screw, and the screw tapers down to a very small end. So the fish get caught in this screw, and it rotates down. They're all alive. They're all in water, and it drops them into a live well or live tank. And so our biologists, you can run that thing 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You don't have to have somebody there. And so periodically, our people go out there and pull those traps and then count the number of fish. They might take genetic samples off of there. They measure them, and they identify as to which juvenile run they are. And so they do that just about every day of the year, and they also do it at night, particularly in some cases when the river's flowing real high. We have to go out there and run those traps because you could fill those traps up with so many fish they die. So we have people that are going out there all night long, sometimes running those traps, and it can be very difficult. It's not always sunny and warm out there. It can be cold and the flows are high. It can be somewhat hazardous, but we train all of our people and they all trained with safety. We haven't had an issue yet with that, but it's pretty hard. And those people work really hard in long hours. That's the life of a field biologist. You get out in the field and you kind of got to go when the fish are there, because fish don't work 9 to 5. And so our biologists are out there all the time working.
Yeah, that sounds kind of scary, going out there at night with a high river flow. That doesn't sound like fun at all.
Well, we do it. Yeah, we do. It's really interesting. If you look at flows, they'll come up really quick, and then we won't send people out there because there's a lot of debris in the water. The trees start falling down, but after a while, it kind of stabilizes, and so we will have people go out there when it's much safer. But it's that first rise, that head, the river comes up and everything flows down. That's the most hazardous situation to be in. But most of the time, and when it starts dropping, you're in good shape. But they're very careful about where they go out. And we can actually watch the river flows. And there's a very good system that NOAA has for predicting flows in the river based upon precipitation. So we can anticipate when the flows are going to be high. We'll go out and run the traps, maybe pull the traps if we think it's going to be really bad. So it's quite the system, and that's one of the improvements that have happened over the last years, is that there's a lot more predictive tools to tell you when the river's coming up, when it's coming down, so you can safely operate. It's scary, but if you know what you're doing and you're well trained, you can operate safely in those conditions.
Well, what are some of the kind of the mysteries for you as a biologist, things that you are really interested in resolving, some of the things that we really don't understand about the fish in the river?
I like to think, it's been my experience, is that you just think you know what's going on. You think you've got it all dialed in about how the fish are, how the fish are behaving, how they're moving, how you can predict maybe how many are going to come back up. And you just think you got it dialed up, and then they fool you. They do something different. And that's kind of the thing that's kept me going for a long time, is trying to understand them. But it's very difficult to study fish and understand them completely because they're underwater. And that's not a natural environment that most people live in. So we have to infer on that. So probably the greatest mystery for me right now is how does sturgeon manage to survive in this system, green sturgeon particularly, given that they're so old, and how do they move and where do they go out in the ocean? Salmon, we pretty much know what's going on with them, but predicting how the ocean will affect them, we pretty much know in the river what's going on, but those ocean conditions can be very variable, and they can drive the populations. And so that's probably the biggest mystery for me, is how does the ocean, it's a huge area out there, affect the populations, and can you predict their effects in terms of the adults coming back? So that's probably the biggest mystery, is the ocean environment and how it affects salmon, especially how it may affect salmon as the climate changes, or as these droughts come along. It's very interesting, and those are big mysteries for me.
And what are some of the misconceptions that people have about what people like you and your colleagues do?
The biggest probably misconception, the biologists, most of the time when people see us out there working, it's a nice day. It's a very clear day, because that's when people like to go out and interact with our people. And so, but they don't see them when they're out there when it's dark. They don't see them when the flows are high. So one of the misconceptions, especially for people that want to get into the field, is that it's not always peaches and cream. It's very much a very hard, it's hard work, and you need to continue to do that. You need to, as a field biologist, and that's one of the lucky things that I've been able to do, is that I've been able to see and participate in a lot of field biology, gathering new data, new information, long-term monitoring projects. We've been monitoring the juvenile numbers, passage estimates at Red Bluff since 1995. So that's very unusual to have those kinds of long-term monitoring programs, and it's been very good for us. But we still don't know everything. And every day I go into work, there's something new that seems to come up that we didn't quite understand. So just continuing to do that work is very, very important.
There's one last question I have for you. I think it's the last question, is that it's been several years now since the Red Bluff Diversion Dam, which is like, you know, pretty much kind of the halfway point or midpoint in the Sacramento River system, has kept its gates up and not dammed the flow. Have you observed any interesting changes in the fishery from that happening? Has that really done what they hoped it would do?
Yes, it has. There were two things that the dam did. It blocked adult salmon, or delayed their migration up to the upper river in the Redding area, where the coldest water is and the best habitat is. So that delayed fish. And when the dam came up, then those fish could get up there. And so we've seen distribution changes of adult spawning. They're spawning further upstream than they did when the dam was in. So that's a good thing. And then on the downstream side, when fish would come, when juveniles that were the fish that did make it up above the dam and spawned, then the fish that moved downstream would be eaten by pike minnow primarily. And so when that, when those dam gates come up, predation by pike minnow was gone because they would build up below the dam. So that's been two good things. An interesting thing that seems to have happened that I hear from fishermen and from some biologists is that the striped bass didn't used to go beyond Red Bluff. The big adults would stop at Red Bluff. They didn't use ladders very well. The fish ladders weren't designed to pass them. So they'd build up below Red Bluff, and so they'd eat the fish there. But what I've been hearing since the Red Bluff Diversion Dam gates have been going up, especially during the summer, we have striped bass moving further up in the system. And so that's been, some people think that's bad because it's creating more predators upstream. But those predators were downstream of the dam. So I don't have all the data or all the information to see if it's, again, we had predation below the dam. We don't have that anymore. Now maybe we have more predation above the dam. But it's in a wild environment. It's, you know, the salmon that are moving downstream can hide from them in cover, etc. Below the diversion dam, there was no place to hide. They just come through that dam, get thrown up in the air, and they were easy pickings. So I think it's, you know, I've heard a lot of information from the guides, etc. And they think that's a problem, but I don't know, because we used to have lots of predation below Red Bluff. We don't have anymore.
And then lastly, you mentioned the fishing guides. How much, you know, interaction do you have and information do you glean from the fishing guides on the Sacramento River and the fishermen?
We hear a lot of things from the fishermen, you know, especially observations about predators. But from a scientific standpoint, they're good. It's good for us to know what they're seeing. But in a lot of cases, you know, we're interested in what they don't see. We're interested in the temperatures that these fish may be spawning at. We're interested in how many go by at a certain time. We're interested in the fish that they catch, because that's one of the primary things we do this for. The work that I do is to provide fish for fishermen, provide fish for our children. And so I used to fish a lot more than I do now. And so I think it's important that the guides are out there providing, you know, for a person to go out and catch salmon. It's really important. And because that's what we do a lot of our work for, is to provide fish for fishermen and provide people fish for people, especially in the ocean, as the commercial fishing that occurs out there.
And we haven't even mentioned that there's a significant rainbow trout population in the upper part of the system, in what we call the lower Sacramento below the dam, isn't there?
Yes, there's a trophy resident trout population below Keswick. You know, extends quite a ways down. We don't know. Yeah, that's probably one of the mysteries that we talked about earlier. We don't know a lot about that population. We know those fish can get very large, but they don't go anywhere. They just grow in that area. What we're starting to find, there's a Davis researcher that's collecting basic primary productivity information and benthic invertebrates or insects or bugs, and he's finding that below Redding is some of the highest productivity for invertebrates and plankton that he's been able to measure, and especially when you look at some of the spring-fed streams that are really productive in above Shasta, in McLeod, at Hat Creek. So that's some new information that we're seeing, but it's one that we don't know a lot about that trout population, except they grow big and there's a lot of them. And so trying to get a little more information about that. And it's a great fishery. It sustains a lot of guides and quite a big fishery. And you won't find that anywhere else in California, that kind of a trophy fishery for salmon in the Central Valley, or for steel, for the trout. Yeah,
because it really is kind of a secret thing for Northern California, that's one of the greatest trout fisheries in the world.
Yes, it very much is. And those fish do not grow, you know, they've got to have something to eat. And so I've always felt that. And this researcher who is now gathering that information finds that, yeah, it's really productive. And part of that productivity is because of Shasta Dam. It produces a lot of plankton that move on down through the dam, through the river, and it's cold water. It's stable, relatively stable flows. It doesn't dry up. And so that creates a very productive area below this big reservoir. That's not uncommon across the country to see very productive fisheries. It might be a warm water fishery in the Midwest, but it's not unusual for these big reservoirs to create a situation by which they produce. It's a little warmer, so they produce very productive fisheries below their dams.
Well, we're out of time, but thanks so much for sharing all of this insight with us about, you know, what really is one of the world's great fisheries, the Sacramento River.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks to our guest, Jim Smith, from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Next up, we're going to talk to Mike Rasmussen, a fishing guide whose livelihood depends on the Sacramento River's game fish populations. You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. So tell me about how this began for you. Like, when did you first catch the bug to fish? Because I think we all think of, you know, I know as a child, you know, I had relatives that took me out fishing. Where did you grow up and what waters, you know, did you start fishing on and catch the bug to enjoy fishing?
I grew up here locally in Chico. I had grandparents up in the Sierras where I spent the summers trout fishing. You know, I think like a lot of people around here, I grew up locally in the North State, trout fishing up in the mountains was kind of a big thing, you know. And I had my other grandparents were over on the coast on the Russian River where steelhead fishing was real prevalent. And that's kind of the basis for my fishing as a young man. I started to fish on the Sacramento River, for American shad and trout and steelhead, you know. Growing up as well, just a little later in my life, maybe, you know, from age 10, 12 until I was in high school and I'd ride my bike out to the river to fish.
Well, you know, recreational fishing, like, you know, what I do and millions of Americans do, is way different from being a professional and being a guide and being expected to, you know, take people out and catch fish. So I'd like to know a little bit about, like, you know, what's the process? It seems to me you've got to kind of have a scientific method approach, if you will, of going out and learning about the river and what works and what doesn't over time, to where you really learn the ins and outs of getting your customers into the fish. So could you describe that process a little bit? Like, what have you learned over the years that's really been valuable for you?
So I think the number one thing that helped me get on my way was working with other guides that aren't around anymore. The fishing magician, Frank Townley, from Corning, my hometown. You know, you deckhand on their boats and you learn the trade, you know, from them and how they did it. You know, when you're younger, you're gung-ho and you just want to go for it. And you know, it's the experience you get when you take someone fishing and they tell you, you know, that's the best day I've had in my life, or that's the best fishing I've ever had. Or, you know, that was when you'd have a day or days like that, that's what really kept you going. And that's what made me, you know, want to continue guiding, to hear that. You know, that's something special to me. I certainly remember my best days, or some of my best days fishing, and to be able to give that to another individual is really what we, you know, what we started doing this for.
You know, I'd like to ask you, one of the things that struck me and drew me to you and made me want to have you as a guest was a blog post you had on your fishing report about a salmon kill on Butte Creek, which is one of the tributaries of the Sacramento River, of the Chinook salmon. And I'd like to know, you know, what are your thoughts on the sustainability of the fishery and your role as a fishing guide in that, making sure that those, you know, that the salmon are there for your future and future generations. What's your views on that?
You know, it's an extensive topic. But to start with Butte Creek, I think there's organizations in place with Butte Creek, Friends of Butte Creek in particular, that have gathered together and made sure to try and ensure that those spring run salmon continue to move up Butte Creek like they always have. You know, when I saw that die off occur, I obviously get emotional, and it's a little personal because of what I do. The sustainability of our salmon need water, first of all, and we're in a state and a time in our state that water is a necessity for other things like big agricultural growth, to provide Southern California with the waters they need. It's a fight for the water, and the salmon kind of come last, you know, as far as monies and importance. The salmon unfortunately fall last, and you know, I fight and get protective of the salmon, but it comes down to water, and that's something we're going to always be fighting. You know, the striped bass, it's a little different. You know, they don't need the same criteria that the salmon needs, so they're around. But the salmon are very sensitive to water temperatures, water flows. When they migrate out as babies, when they come back as adults, it's a very, very water sensitive issue, I guess, for the salmon to keep in existence here in the North State. And lots of things have changed with the flows, the amount of water needed, you know. So we're fighting that on a daily and annual deal. And what you saw in Butte Creek was just one accident that happened, you know. But a salmon going a three-year cycle for reproduction, if you miss a whole year of production, you know, it's a pretty substantial thing.
Are salmon the fish that you prize the most as a guide to go fishing for? Is that the fish that you enjoy fishing for the most?
Sure, I actually have a soft spot in my heart for steelhead. I grew up doing that, and like they had the same issues with water in a lot of California rivers. Salmon is our biggest income as far as guides are concerned. You know, that brings us the most money by far out of the few things we fish for. The salmon definitely is the most important as far as income. I do love fishing for salmon. I love seeing the salmon around on a personal level. I used to see him up the creeks. I've seen him here in Chico and Lindo Channel and in Upper Park growing up. You know, we'd go swim up there and see the springers would still be in the river when we were up at Bear Hole and Salmon Hole. Then, you know, very few fish, if any, make it up there these days, you know. But that goes back to my childhood and seeing them right here in downtown Chico and then up in Upper Park and rivers like Deer Creek rivers and creeks that the salmon all used to go up that now, you know, now they don't even flow into the Sacramento River, mainly because of, you know, nut production and agricultural things. And it's a sign of the times, and hatcheries were put in place to protect against some of the loss of habitat, you know, and it's all it's all trying to figure itself out right now. Unfortunately, it's a hard time for the salmon.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. We will return to our conversation with Sacramento River fishing guide Mike Rasmussen after a short break. Stay with us, and thanks for listening. Back. Let's return to our visit with Sacramento River fishing guide Mike Rasmussen as we examine the state of the river's game fish populations. Well, let's talk about some of the fun stuff. When you take clients out on the river, what are some of the misconceptions people have about being a fishing guide? Like, what are some of the things that, like, people that don't do what you do don't understand about, you know, how difficult it is, for example?
Well, I mean, I guess number one thing is the pressure of, you know, performing, you know, on a daily basis. Of course, you know, people that come out a lot or people that fish a lot will know fishing is fishing. Some days you just, you know, are going to be tougher than others. We're still subject to things happening that you know, change from day to day. I could go for 4 or 5 days in a row and we could catch limits of fish, and then, you know, on the fifth day something weather related or water related changes, and there you are with a group of customers that, you know, last 5 days have been, you know, pretty easy, and then you're stuck with the realization that, oh man, they're just not going to bite today, or you know, things along that nature. And that's super hard to swallow as a guide, because you pride yourself in being professional, and we haven't figured everything out about the fish yet, you know. And some days they can leave you scratching your head. And other than that, you know, really do enjoy what we do. And I love seeing smiles put on people's faces. I love taking kids fishing, seeing kids light up and catching fish. You know, that kind of goes back to my childhood and certain times fishing. Growing up, kind of, you know, then you'll never forget them. And when I see that, you know, light up in someone else's face, it makes me feel like I'm doing my job. You know, it's what I started doing it for. And there is certainly hard days. You know, people don't realize we start, you know, some days 3:30 in the morning, and we've seldom stopped before dark. So our days are long. We see a lot of sun is another thing. And it kind of wears on you, but, you know, just the drive to keep taking people and giving them the opportunity to catch fish they wouldn't ordinarily catch, or to catch amount of fish they wouldn't ordinarily catch, and to see them happy in the end, that's what does it for us, you know. Does it for me, anyway.
Could you share with us, like, maybe one special day or a client you remember, maybe somebody who wasn't an experienced fisherman that you had just a really great experience with?
I would, yeah. I have one in particular just sticking out right now. Last year on the Feather River, it was kind of different. We were doing our salmon fishing on the Feather River last year because of the flows and that's kind of where the fish were. So I got a text in the middle of the day as I was finishing one group of fishermen, the first group of the day, and I got a text from someone that was on the bank over there. And I randomly do, you know, pick up people on the bank or something, and I'll take them out if I can, you know, just to, I don't know, just as a good faith thing, you know, keep the good karma coming. Well, I got a text, and I looked at it and said, hey, I'm over here with my nephew, and he's never got a salmon before, and he's physically and mentally delayed. And I thought, you know, the banks at the outlet hole are kind of primal, as far as that goes, for fishing in Orville. So when I finished my group, I came over and got them and took them out in the boat. And this gentleman hooked a 30-pound salmon, and it was the happiest, truly happy I'd seen anyone in a long time, and totally thankful, totally happy, and it not only made my day, it made my season. And I still go out with his family members and him now. We still get together and have fished several times since. But yeah, just that sense of truly providing an opportunity for someone, you know, that doesn't always get it, and having to be successful, and the gratitude you see, you know, on their face, that does it for me.
What's your take on the overall health of the Sacramento River over the time that you've been on it over the years? How is it doing as a waterway and a fishery?
Sadly, I'm 40 years old, so I was taking my dad would take me out on the Sacramento River, and I'd go with a few other family friends, and I used to, I say, let's use a Las Bolinas as example. We go try and trout or steelhead fish at Las Bolinas when the salmon came, you know, salmon were done spawning and the steelhead came in, and we wouldn't fish for steelhead on the Sacramento River until 300 a day were coming over the Red Bluff Diversion Dam. And the salmon would come over the Red Bluff Diversion Dam in the thousands. And you would physically see, you know, several hundred salmon spawning on any riffle from Corning to, you know, Cottonwood, California. Any riffle or gravel bar on the river had dozens and dozens, if not hundreds and hundreds of salmon spawning on them. And, you know, you'd try and fish behind them for the steelhead. Now, those are considered naturally spawning salmon. I have not seen a naturally spawning salmon on a riffle between Las Molinas and Cottonwood, California in at least 6, 8, 10 years. So it's mainly come down to being dependent on the hatchery, which, you know, when you put all your eggs in one basket, you know, anything can happen. So as far as the health of the river, I mean, the river is set up, it could be still, you know, much better than it is. I think there's just a few things that would have to change, that need to change, to bring back salmon how they were, especially the fall run is mainly what I'm speaking of. And right now it's at a pretty desperate time of existence.
If there was one thing you could wave your magic wand and see done to improve that, what would it be?
Boy, that's a tough one. I guess if everybody could work together and give the water allotments needed during the run timing for the salmon, I guess that would be the number one deal. Like I started out saying, the salmon are dependent on water, and the way the water is allotted now just isn't user-friendly for the salmon. And if we could come together or, you know, work together, I think it could still be done. It's not that there's not enough water, it's that the timing of the water releases and the water flows and allotment are just doesn't do the salmon any favors.
Finally, I'd kind of like to ask you about the seasons on the Sacramento River, because it changes, you know, through the year. Could you kind of give us a sense of, as a guide, what the Sacramento River fishery is like and what you fish for and what the conditions are like through the year, starting with now in the spring?
Well, our flows are pretty controlled now, with the exception of winter and early spring. When we get runoff and rain that, you know, isn't controllable, and it makes the creeks that aren't dammed up, makes them rise and fall according to the weather. So for the most part, from like this time of year on, we'll be under controlled flows. So the salmon, right now we're just finishing up our striper season on the Sacramento River and the Feather River. But the Sacramento River is just about finishing up. The water temperatures downriver have reached somewhere, you know, around 65 to 70 degrees, and the stripers are spawning. So from here on out, the rice is starting to grow. So a fair amount of water is getting taken for the rice right now, and it creates that warmer water downriver. So salmon season doesn't start until mid-July and doesn't really get good enough for us to guide until August 1st to the 15th now, just due to run timing of the Chinook salmon and Coleman National Fish Hatchery, kind of, you know, what they release now, the early fish don't come anymore around the opener. But the river will open, and our flows will be sustained somewhere, you know, between 7 and 10,000 cubic feet per second from Keswick, and it stays the same. So as the Chinook start to migrate up, we start actively fishing for them as guides, you know, middle of August through September and October, September and October being our better months. And then, you know, come early fall, we get another run of salmon actually on the Sacramento River that we're allowed to fish for. It's the late fall run Chinook salmon. So around Halloween through December 16th when the season closes, we get the larger Chinook salmon of the year. It's the late fall run where we sometimes get fish 40 plus pounds. You know, definitely always several in the 30s, and it's just a bigger class of fish.
Wow.
And we get the big striped bass that come in and hold over for the next year. We also start to fish for them later in the fall and through the winter, depending on the water. And, you know, both of those fisheries are subject to, you know, an early winter rain or some runoff that'll dirty up the river. And the Sacramento River doesn't clear real fast. So, it may take us out of business for a week or so that time of year. But it's kind of a weather-depending thing. And after that, we don't do a lot on the Sacramento River through the winter months until the sturgeon start coming in, which we start targeting sometime around, you know, late February, March. That's kind of the year's cycle, you know. This big spring striper run starts generally the last week of March or the first week of April, and we do about a month and a half of that. And that's kind of how the cycle goes on the Sacramento River. There's other rivers we do venture to for steelhead on the coast and other things, but the Sacramento River keeps us busy most of the year.
Well, Mike, thanks so much, and I appreciate you, you know, making the effort to come in.
Thank you, Dave. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks to our guests, fishing guide Mike Rasmussen and Jim Smith, project leader for the United States Fish and Wildlife Service's Red Bluff office. If you missed a show or want to share this one with friends, you can find this and past programs on our website, mynspr.org. Never miss a show by subscribing to Blue Dot at NPR Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at NSPR News and me at Dave Schlom. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Our producer and engineer is the man on the board, Nolan Ford. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.